Good morning and welcome to the Chelan County Board of Directors meeting. Today is September 4th. We're starting our study session at 10 and we'll move into our business session this afternoon at 1 o'clock. There are three commissioners present in the room and Commissioner Congdon is available to us via telephone. Head table, Steve Ryder, General Manager, Rebecca, Clerk, and Eric Walquist, Attorney. Cell phones. Please be in some kind of a neutral position that doesn't disrupt the meeting, and I'll spare you the Albuquerque joke again. If you choose as a guest to address the commission, please do so. Utilize the microphone in front because our meetings are recorded, and we would like your name, your address, and we will provide for you a reasonable time. With that being said, I'm looking for Janet Jaspers. There she is, Heidi. Not you weren't hiding, I was couldn't see through to you. Janet, appreciate you delivering our Pledge of Allegiance and our safety.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic which stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So today's safety meeting, you can choose your topic. And so I was trying to think of something. I thought, I know two people just recently who have been stung by yellow jackets who were kind of close to me. And I thought, that'd be a good topic. And Dave said, go for it. So anyway, I'm going to cover some quick facts first, bite prevention and then bite treatment. So quick facts. Yellow jackets are actually more aggressive than other stinging hornets and mud daubers and bees. And this one I thought I knew, but I wasn't really sure. Yellow jackets can both sting and bite, and often they bite to get a better grip so that they can sting you even harder.
Yes.
So they do not lose their stinger, and they can sting numerous times, unlike a bee. And worse yet, if you squash them or squish them, they release a pheromone that lets other wasps or yellow jackets try to attack. They are more numerous in the fall, as I've kind of noticed around our house. And as they do get more aggressive and more aggressive as the summer goes on, as they prepare for winter. The nests, although they might last through the winter, they're not used next year. They like to build new nests every year. And they have an appetite for protein, like my steak or my ribs on the picnic plate. And sugar-rich foods like sodas or desserts. So how you can combat those yellow jackets? First of all, don't leave any uncovered trash. If you're having a picnic, try to keep all of your serving bowls covered until it's time to serve and then cover them back up. Don't leave pet food out overnight. Pick up all your empty soda glasses or drink glasses. Ripe fruit seems to be one of their favorites. You can look for ways to obstruct or plug holes. They seem to love one of our rock holes that my husband's always kind of squirting in the cracks. If you do choose to spray the nest, you might want to wait till it's dark or moonlit when they're inactive. This is my one that's favorite, but really hard for me to do. Remain calm. Brush it away. I kind of panic like that. I try to remain calm. You can avoid wearing bright colored clothes. If you happen to get bit or stung, wash the site immediately. Ice helps. If you take a little bit of baking soda with the water to make paste, that seems to neutralize the venom. If you need any pain relief, you can use acetaminophen and ibuprofen.
Janet, thank you. Questions, comments?
I just want to say that it's very timely. We have just a bunch of yellow jackets at our house. Of course, the fact that we grow lavender doesn't help. But they're just a nuisance, like you said. We can't sit outside and have dinner this time of year.
Thank you. Very timely. Thank you. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Let's take a look at the approval of the agenda. Commissioners, what are your desires to deal with the agenda?
I have no changes. No changes.
No changes? Ann, any changes in your mind?
I'm sorry, I'm on mute. No, no changes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Then we will accept the agenda as presented. General Manager Steve Wright, Yakima Nation Agreement.
So I want to invite Aline and Ian up to discuss. You know, we don't talk as much about issues regarding environmental stewardship as many of our other values, in part because the HCP, the Habitat Conservation Plan, is in many respects just kind of motoring along, doing its thing and doing well. Today we have the opportunity to talk about something that is important in the Mid-Columbia Coho Reintroduction Funding Agreement, because this is a part of the Habitat Conservation Plan. It's a part that wasn't fully understood when the plan was put in place. There was some planning work needed and then moving to operations. So here's a chance to hear a little bit about something that is an important value for us, which is how we protect the environment. Aline?
Thanks, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, I'm Aline Underwood, manager of our Fish and Wildlife Department. And here with me today is Ian Adams, our hatchery maintenance and operations coordinator. I'd also like to acknowledge Catherine Willard, who is also here. She's our senior fisheries biologist, and we've been working for over about a year and a half trying to come up with the best agreement to fund Coho moving forward. So I want to acknowledge that. So why are we here today? We want to discuss the proposed 15-year new funding agreement with the Yakima Nation for continuation of our HCP Coho obligation. And also really important to note is this is just for informational purposes today. We don't plan to have an ask, if you will, and we'd like to return September 17th for authorization to execute the agreement that we'll discuss today. So some really good background. As Steve mentioned, we don't have an opportunity to come and talk about the things that we're doing in our HCP that often. This is actually a pretty good news story. So we're going to give some background on what our obligations are. We're going to describe the program as it is. We're going to talk about our proposed agreement and those terms. Ian's going to go over some cost-effectiveness considerations that we made, ultimately what is our HCP credit, and then we'll talk about next steps. So as you all know, habitat conservation plans satisfy our FERC obligations for our Rocky Reach and Rock Island project licenses. While protecting salmon and steelhead. So under the HCPs, hatchery programs are part of achieving no net impact. That's our 7% of our no net impact on salmon and steelhead migrating past Rocky Reach and Rock Island dams. So at the time the HCPs were signed, sort of officially signed in 2004, Coho no longer existed in the Mid-Columbia River. They were pretty prolific down in the lower river, but they had essentially been extirpated in the upper Columbia. But Section 843A of both our Rocky Reach and Rock Island HCPs contemplated coho as a plant species. This was done in a very deliberate fashion. So the folks who put together the HCPs recognized that if coho were to ever become listed, that we would want to make sure that all of our obligations were certain and predictable over time. That's why coho were actually included in the HCP, is to make sure that we accounted for if they are present, if they were listed, we would have no new obligations to satisfy other than those that were already included in the HCP if that happened. So basically, they have the 7% hatchery mitigation production requirement as any other species.
Aline, you used a word, and I think I heard it right, extirpated?
Yes.
Tell me.
Suzanne told me I shouldn't use that word.
No, but. I appreciate it. Oh, God. Why do I feel trapped here? Tell me, share that definition with me, because it's not one I'm necessarily familiar with, but I think it has weight.
Yes, and I apologize. That means that coho no longer existed. So okay. They were essentially, they used to exist back in the 30s. And then they just had sort of a precipitous decline due to various factors, and so they are no longer present.
Okay.
So extinct, sort of.
Okay. In the upper river. Become ex partes.
Basically, yes.
Okay.
Yes. So on and June.
Thank you for using the word.
Yes, of course. So in 2007, a few years after our HCPs were signed, the HCP hatchery committees, and those again are the folks that are signatories to the HCPs, the hatchery committee is tasked with making sure that we implement our hatchery programs in the most cost-effective way, consistent with the terms set forth in our HCP. They agreed that the district should begin providing hatchery compensation for coho salmon. So up until that point, there had been no coho program available. There were no coho really in the river. But a program was introduced by the Acoma Nation to reintroduce coho. And so at that time, the Hatchery Committee agreed that we should begin funding that program. So officially in August of 2007, the Hatchery Committee approved funding the Acoma Nation coho program, sort of their pilot program, if you will, for 10 years. And we would fulfill our hatchery obligations. Similarly, in January of just this year, the Hatchery Committee approved the coho program, basically a continuation of that program, as satisfying our HCP obligations so long as we could enter into an agreement with the Acoma Nation. So I want to talk just really briefly about the Acoma Nation coho program. It's very simple. The objective of the coho reintroduction program is to reestablish naturally spawning coho populations in the mid-Columbia tributaries. Again, they are present in the lower Columbia. The Acoma Nation is a very important entity as they are the lead entity for coho reintroduction into the Wenatchee and Methouse subbasins since about the 1990s. And lead entity basically means they're the ones that have chosen to take on this project and move it forward. So Bonneville Power Administration completed a coho master program as the main funder on behalf of the Yakimas and began funding that program in 2007 under the Fish Accord. They fund it to this day. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we funded a share of the program as well from 2007 until December of 2017 when our 10-year term was up. And then historically, Grant and Douglas Puties have also funded their respective share of this program. So the current status is we had a 10-year funding agreement. It expired December 31st of 2017, and we've spent the last year and a half exploring options for future compliance. So I'll turn it over to Ian now to discuss some of the alternatives that we have been considering.
Yeah, as Lynn mentioned, we spent quite a bit of time looking at alternatives to working solely with the Yakima Nation on this project. And the first alternative we considered was how do we leverage our existing infrastructure to create our own coho program? And the simple answer is we don't have enough infrastructure currently to incubate, rear, acclimate these fish. And in addition to that, the stakeholders are HC committee members all unanimously support our involvement with the Yakima Nation program because they are not interested in having duplicate programs in the Wenatchee and Methow basins. Another alternative we actually looked at was can we just build the infrastructure we need to create our own coho program and basically control the destiny of that program. And the cost of that.
Okay. May I ask a question?
Yeah.
No excess capacity. So somewhere along the line, we had to ask the question, is there value in creating a duplicate, essentially, process? What was the question behind the question? Why would we want to do that?
Well, we want to do that to determine if, frankly, the cost of the Acoma Nation is offering to us is a fair and reasonable cost compared to what it would take for us to build and maintain and operate our own program. So aside from the biological nature of that, there's just from a financial standpoint, you know, we own the facilities that we own, and so if we can leverage any of those, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Great answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Ian, for letting me interrupt you.
Yeah, you bet. So we then looked at what would it cost us to build infrastructure to create our own COHO program. And we ran into the same issues that we had in the leveraging our own infrastructure alternative, which is we have some of the pieces, but we don't have them all. And the pieces that we need to complete a program are millions of dollars. And to make things more complicated, you've got permitting issues. For example, I think you're probably all well aware that there's a phosphorus TMDL in the Wenatchee River, and the ecology has said that there's no new discharges. So hurdles like that are preventing us from moving forward with a COHO program with constructing our own infrastructure. And I also wanted to point out that Aline mentioned this earlier, we have sunk a lot of money into this program already with the Yakima Nation in their 10-year pilot program that we've been involved with since 2007. So the best way for us to move forward was to work with the Yakima Nation. We drafted an agreement, and the agreement has a proposed 15-year cost share. Kind of a hybrid of the first alternative, which was using our own infrastructure. We have provided, as part of this agreement, the Tumwater and our two Dryden trapping locations for broodstock collection, and that helps us offset costs a little bit because the Yakima Nation won't have to build that infrastructure in, which would then end up costing us. We also have offered up the use of our currently idle Rocky Reach Annex facility, although that is a future agreement that we're working on with the Yakima Nation. They're considering use of that facility. And we have a mutual termination with exceptions in case of a material breach or if the Yakima Nation can't meet our HCP credit requirements. And the cost is a pretty big price tag, $605,000 a year, with a not to exceed $9.7 million over 15 years. But when you get to the next slide, what you'll see is that cost, when it's divided up per smolt, is actually pretty cheap compared to some of the other programs we're currently working with different agencies on. $3.52 per smolt is about 55% of what we're paying for similar programs that we have for meeting our HCP requirements.
Question, if I could jump in. How does that cost per smolt compare to, say, a smolt from our hatchery, the cost?
It's actually cheaper. I don't have the exact amount. How much is cheaper?
So it costs more for a smolt from our hatchery?
It does, yeah. Okay. So one of our comparisons is our Chihuahua Spring Chinook program. So those are fish that we collect, we rear, and we final acclimate. And the cost per smolt on that one is $3.98. For another Spring Chinook program, this is the Madhouse Spring Chinook program. This is a partnership with Douglas PUD. The cost per smolt on that is $8.63. So what I did was we actually averaged. So on average, depending on who the funding partner is or whether it's us, on average it costs us about $6.31 a smolt.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And I also want to point out that Douglas and Grant PUDs are entering into similar agreements with the Yakima Nation. I'm not familiar with the details on their agreements, but this is a joint funding effort on all of our parts to reintroduce the COHO into the Wenatchee and Mahow bases. And as Lynn mentioned earlier, I also wanted to point out again that so long as we are holding up to the terms of the agreement, we're meeting our HCP compensatory credit for our COHO mitigation and production levels. What's important to point out is in the quotes on the slide, you'll see even if actual production levels vary from year to year, and as you all know, salmon runs can be very dynamic. Some years we'll have light returns and some years we'll have big returns. So long as we're paying the agreed sum and we're meeting the terms of the agreement, those fluctuations don't have any bearing on our ability to meet our HCP goals.
So may I jump in here, Dennis?
Yes, you may, and please.
Yeah. Hi, Ian. This is Ann Congdon. So, yeah, that was my question, and you may have answered it. So just by virtue of the fact that we are donating that amount of money, or not donating, we're paying the Yakima Nation for this program, just by virtue of the payment of money, paying the fee, we meet our HCP obligation. So we don't have to, or they don't have to show, they must have to show at some point that this is adding to the no net impact that we need to achieve. I mean, where is the accountability on this? It sounds like we just pay the money and then we get our, you know, then we can walk away and we met our obligation.
So that's a good question, Commissioner Congdon. So the simplest answer is we are but a very small portion of this funding agreement, roughly about 10%. And so the largest contributor to the agreement is BPA. So they have quite an onerous – pardon?
The BPA, right? BPA, is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay.
So they have quite an onerous reporting and documentation structure, which is one sort of way that we know that there's certainty that they're going to do the things that they say they're going to do. Additionally, our hatchery committee is involved in getting updates about how the COHO program is going, and it's really incumbent on all of the hatchery committee members to ensure that while the agreement that we will have with the Yakimas is written that we fund, therefore we get credit, the committee isn't going to be interested in us funding a program that doesn't have a meaningful outcome at the end. So the whole program is intended to reintroduce a self-sustaining population of COHO, and both Bonneville and all of us as joint funders and the Hatchery Committee are responsible for making sure that happens.
Okay, so that makes sense. So the committee, one of the main functions of the committee is to monitor that and determine that we are, you know, that we are meeting that no net impact goal, right?
I would say that the function of the committee is to ensure that the program is going as the Yakimas have put out that it should go, that they've planned for it to go, they've put the infrastructure in place, they have staffed it appropriately, they provided resources for the program. But by the nature of doing this agreement, we do meet our no net impact requirement.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thanks, Aline.
No problem. So that's a really good segue into our summary slide about the benefits. So essentially, this guarantees the district meets our HCP obligations for COHO through 2032. 15 years is really a long time, especially when we're able to have predictable expenses for the next 15 years. A benefit is we've got continuity and stability with the known program and organization. We've been working with the Yakima Nation for, you know, 15, 20 years. We have a proven record with them. They also have a proven program that, you know, we've been funding the pilot program. They're now in full-scale implementation of the program. So that's a known thing for us. And we have long-term certainty of costs regardless of other funders. So, for instance, as the Yakima Nation is working through their extension of their accords with BPA, regardless of what happens with that, we're locked in at a set price for the next 15 years, regardless of what happens with those other funders. And then again, the Hatchery Committee approves and supports the program. We get a return on our initial investment into the pilot for the past 10 years, and we have a known commodity moving forward.
At least, I think, last question for me, if I look where the Wenatchee River is and then the Mount Howell River Basin, those are the primary areas where – are those the primary areas where the coho are being reared and released from?
Yes.
Which means that as they travel down the river and up the river, they become subject to the Bonneville Buffet?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking. Thank you.
Yes. So our next steps is we'd like to return on September 17th to request authorization to execute the long-term agreement. And with that, we take any questions anyone has.
Very quickly, in a short span of time, can you just inform me on the life cycle of a coho so that once it's released,
Sure.
Yeah.
So in most ways, coho are no different than other, you know, whether it's Chinook or steelhead. I would say the main difference is once they're reared, they outmigrate as juveniles, just like other fish do. They typically only spend a year in the ocean. So we get some of the Chinook that spend 1, 2, 3, 4, though not so much these days, years in the ocean and then come back. So one of the reasons coho can have a very variable return from year to year, and we do see that, is because only 1 year in the ocean, if it's not a great year due to whatever factor, it can really affect the return. So that's probably the biggest difference.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
The committee makeup, could you just describe that a little bit to me, please?
Yes. Yeah, so the members of our hatchery committee are all of those signatories to the HCPs. Mm-hmm. So we have Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. We have U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Marine Fisheries Service, the Confederated Bands and Tribes of the Yakama Nation, and the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation.
Thank you. It's an impressive group overseeing that operation.
It certainly is.
Okay. Any other questions? Ann?
No, thanks.
All right. Thanks, you guys, very much.
Thank you.
See you on the 17th.
Okay.
Yep. Full attachments.
Yep. Next up, I'm going to invite Katie Marshall to come up. And we're going to talk a little bit about, we've talked before about the cost of attaching to our poles. And we've been working on an update on that. Katie's going to describe where we are in the process.
Hey. All right. So today we're just going over an overview of the pole attachment rate update. Back last spring, we made a presentation to the board, kind of giving an overall informational presentation on the efforts going into the district's overall update of our pole attachment program. There's four primary components to that. There's the license agreements, business processes, and the construction and design standards. All of which we've had a lot of work go into, but today our focus is just going to be on the rates component. So just as an overview, we'll go over kind of the background that goes into the rate calculation, the rate methodology, the proposed rate that was calculated, various considerations that were applied to the calculation, feedback that we've received on that, as well as a rate alternative, and then the progression of the rate development to date. Just as the note on the bottom there states, we're not asking for any board actions today. This is just an informational presentation. Just to kind of give you guys some background on how pole attachment rates work for PUDs in our state. State law governs pole attachment rates and regulations for PUDs in Washington State. We're one of 20 states that are pre-exempt to the FCC requirements, so we set kind of our own regulations at the state level. Basically, rates should be updated periodically to make sure the calculation methodology aligns with what is stated in state law, as well as making sure the rate inputs reflect our current information from the district, and that the discretionary components of that calculation correspond with our current practices. This next note here is pretty important. The rate calculation is pretty complex. It's taken a lot of effort to get to where we're at. I just want to make sure that everyone knows that while I'm the face of this presenting it to you, it was a collaborative effort with a lot of district subject matter experts in management, and a lot of work went into this by other colleagues at the district, including other customer utilities staff, accounting, strategic financial planning, and legal, just to name a few. At the top right there, I just wanted to also include a note that our rate was last calculated or updated in 1999. So since that time, state law of how to calculate that rate has also changed.
Is
So this slide really gets into the methodology that's prescribed by statute, and I'm going to try to keep it as brief as possible because we can get pretty convoluted if we dive into it too deep. But essentially, the state statute details how a just and reasonable rate must be calculated, and it breaks that calculation down into three subsections. 3A and 3B, the first two subsections, calculate the cost associated with the portion of the pole used by an attachment. So they are the same in that way. They allocate a portion of the pole cost based on how much of the pole is used. Where they differ is how they allocate the cost of the support and clearance space, which you can see in blue on this photo. So that space is really what's required by different design and engineering standards, specifically the National Electric Safety Code, in order to have the clearances we need, the amount of pole in the ground to make it sturdy, and the clearances between the comm space and the electric to make it a safe working environment for everyone. So the first subsection of that calculation allocates that safety space in proportion to the space that's occupied on the pole. The second subsection of the methodology allocates that space equally to anybody that's attached to the pole. And the third portion of that calculation basically instructs that an average of those two components yields a just and reasonable pole attachment rate. Pretty, a lot of info. Is there any questions on this slide while we're here? So in updating the district's rate calculation, we first took all of the language in the statute and interpreted those into mathematical formulas, at which point we analyzed the appropriate data and inputs to apply to that formula. And the resulting rate was $29.89. Further information on the details of that are also available in the appendix of the presentation if you want to really get into some of those components. I've also included the rate that Frontier charges to Land PUD for attaching to their poles, just as a point of reference in reasonableness of our rate. This slide I've included just to emphasize the importance that $29.89 isn't the maximum or minimum rate that the state statute allows us to charge for pole attachments. It's the rate that we've calculated to be a fair rate. Basically, we've analyzed each element and input utilized in the calculation to make sure that the final rate that is calculated complies with the state statute, meets the stated intent that the legislator has put out that they're trying to achieve. And is reflective of associated district costs and practices that correspond to pole attachment.
These are annual rates?
We do, depending on the agreement, but usually semi-annually.
Semi-annual. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Well, and so that's the annual rate, and then it's split into two.
Okay.
So once a year. I guess I made that more complicated than it needed to be.
Yeah, I was doing okay for a
little bit. On the right here, I just have included some discretionary components that go into the formula and the calculation that in the way that we applied them as a district to the calculation resulted in a rate that's lower than what's the maximum allowed by statute. Some of those discretionary inputs include, we didn't include an ROR in the calculation. We applied a discounted pole investment by 15% to account for pole infrastructure that, at least in our system, comm companies don't usually utilize. And we also used a taller than average pole height in calculating our rate because that is reflective of the actual heights of our poles within our system. But basically, the higher the pole height in this calculation, the lower the rate. So an industry norm for height is 37.5 feet. We used 48.19.
Just a quick question. With reference to the state maximum, is the state maximum a calculation or is it a dollar figure?
It's a calculation.
Okay.
So,
okay.
It would make it easier if it was a dollar, right?
Right, yeah.
Any other questions on that slide? The district in June sent a letter to all the attaching parties informing them of our intent to update our attachment rate. As part of this letter, we included the proposed rate as well as the calculation details, and also invited the attachers to provide us comments and ask questions on the rate and or its calculation. To date, we'd received six feedback comments on the calculation in total. Two of those relate to issues that are still pending in the Pacific PUD case regarding pull attachment rates. And four of those feedback comments pertain to elements of the calculation that are not currently part of any litigation. And on those elements, the district feels that we more than satisfy the current standard set by the court. So after reviewing all of the feedback comments that we got and looking at whether or not a change was needed in that calculation, we determined that the formula inputs we used in that initial calculation are reasonable. However, the district staff is recommending that the district adopt an interim rate of 2314 that accounts for the two feedback comments that relate to issues that are still pending in the Pacific PUD case. Once that case concludes, then we would recommend that we recalculate and reevaluate based on what the results of that are. A lot of text on here, but I'll summarize for you. This basically just gives a progression of the rate development to date. Up until now, you know, we started with the analysis of the rate components and calculating the updated rate, a lot of stakeholder outreach for calculation review. Our current efforts involved reviewing those feedback comments received, and we're currently drafting responses, and we'll be sending those to the appropriate parties that supplied those feedback to us. And the last piece of the current efforts is that after presenting this information to the board today, we're hoping that we can get any feedback from the board on the rate between now and October 31st. Next steps then would be including the rate in the annual Board of Commissioners fees and charges update. This usually occurs in November. This is probably a good spot to add a little bit of clarity. The pull attachment rate that we've been discussing throughout this, by district standards, we would normally classify this as a fee and charge. It was moved to fees and charges in 2011. But just to have consistency with industry vernacular that's been around for a long time, we consider using the word rate for our purposes. And basically the last step then would be to implement the updated rate on January 1.
Just want to add a couple of things, clarity, to make sure being clear about what we're asking the board for at this point. So because it's a fees and charge, it's delegated to the general manager for decision making. But there's enough sensitivity around this issue that we don't want to proceed without the board being aware of the direction that we're going. And if you have any feedback for us, we're, of course, open to hearing that. That's why we put in the October 31st date. Fees and charges would normally come forward to the board in November as a decision, and we're just reporting to you on what we've decided and are moving forward with. So if there's something in there that you would like us to know about, you can either tell us today or tell us over the course of the next couple months, and we can take that into account in our thinking as we're making this final. Second thing I'd like to just bring to your attention is that this is worth roughly about $500,000 a year, but half of that is paid by our own fiber system. So it's roughly to the bottom line, about $250,000 a year. And you can see when moving to 11 to 29, if we stop at 23, you get about two-thirds of that. So we capture about two-thirds of the benefit, and we're managing for the risk of what might happen at, as this proceeds through the court, and allows us the opportunity to then reset based on whatever comes out of that court decision.
So you're looking at the interim rate until such time those court proceedings have concluded, and then revisit somewhere down the road.
Probably soon thereafter. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'm assuming for local providers that we put the cost in to do the installation if they're part of our provider, and we recover that installation through rates because I see where we've contacted Comcast and those kinds of things. So, but what's absent here mm-hmm. is Localtel, iFiber.
Oh, so they.
So how do we? Just help me with our relationship there.
Sure. So they actually purchase through our wholesale fiber, so they're mm-hmm. not actually, as far as this program goes, considered attachers on our pole. Those are the attachments that relate to those companies are included in the amount that Steve said is about the 50% that is our fiber, because this deals specifically with the attaching party and not basically any subsidiary beyond that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yep. Any other questions, comments, commissioners?
I just one question. The $23 price is one that manages to risk. So there's been some calculation that's a safe number relative to.
So, litigation. Commissioner, I think of it more as managing to certainty or avoiding the uncertainty that might be associated with, even though we think we've appropriately calculated consistent with the statutory requirements to the full $29 rate, the fact that is still uncertain in terms of the ultimate outcome creates problems on both ends for us. If we charge the full rate, then we have the potential to set aside any litigation risk associated with that. We could have an over-collection issue and a refund issue. And so it's just the uncertainty associated with where that ultimately lands in terms of the court. To date, Pacific has prevailed on every issue. But that said, the lack of certainty, I think, causes us to recommend the interim rate on those issues that are already settled.
I guess my question is, somehow we've come to a comfort at that dollar price versus where it's at now at 11.
In the comment that we received, there were basically six issues that were raised. Only two of those are proceeding in the appeal.
Okay.
So the other four we've reviewed. We feel that we're comfortable with the recommendation that we had originally made, and we don't see a litigation risk associated with those.
Thank you. And your formula is actually, and Katie mentioned this, but it's actually in your documents in the exhibits. Quite complicated with a lot of elements to it. So,
thank you.
Sure. Anything else?
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next up, we want to invite Andy Wendell to come up. He's done an excellent presentation to the. Some of the local governmental organizations regarding the impact of cryptocurrency in residential neighborhoods that I think you would find interesting. And so we wanted to share that with you. And also, he's been invited to go other places, including the county commission. So you'll probably be hearing and seeing more about this.
Good morning, commissioners. Last time we met, I was giving you an update on some of the cryptocurrency zoning aspects, the conversations we're having with other municipalities, the county and the Port District on specific cryptocurrency zoning in the residential, commercial, industrial area. There's an equal and larger effort on the rates and policies that Lindsay Mons is going to be sharing with you here in just a little bit. So, this is a list of stakeholders with respect to zoning. These folks generally are the ones that either input or provide input or set zoning ordinances within the municipalities in the county. And so therefore, we've been meeting with them, having conversations specific to how do we zone for cryptocurrencies. We started back in June, had a great meeting with all the municipalities in the county together, so largely made up of planners and administrators that set those policies. That sparked several other conversations. We've been to the city of Wenatchee since that time in mid-August. We've been to the port a couple of times. I just finished the presentation with the port this morning on the topic, as well as just citing infrastructure in general. So we're moving to the county in September, and we've been having several conversations with INIAT, Chelan, and Cashmere, Leavenworth as well. So we've still got a few dates pending on some of those outlying areas, but we hope to wrap this outreach effort up here before too long. Some of the common themes that we're hearing back from the municipalities in the county are stated here in these slides. I'll just go through a few of them, but certainly establishing the zoning for cryptocurrency is recognized by the municipalities in the county as their responsibility. It is not the PUD's responsibility to set zoning requirements for cryptocurrency. It's well understood that cryptocurrency mining in residential space introduces unique safety concerns and reliability concerns for the PUD as well as the general public. So this has been widely acknowledged by the municipalities in our conversations. In addition, it's recognized cryptocurrency mining is really an industrial or commercial use of the resource. It's not a residential use. Cryptocurrency mining is best served in the industrial and commercial zones. I think there's growing recognition of that and growing support in that as we're moving forward. The other one is, we've heard this a lot, is that the PUD should work to ensure that capacity in our electric infrastructure is there to meet the traditional non-cryptocurrency loads. And we've been hearing that in a variety of different forms. Very important. Specific to the city of Wenatchee, they submitted a list of 7 questions. These are just 3 of them. The entire list of questions is an addendum in the presentation, and a detailed response to those questions is in as an addendum as well. These are some of the things that are coming out, or some of the conversations in these outreach efforts. What is the PUD's opinion about cryptocurrency mining in residential areas and neighborhoods? And is there a threshold or a minimum amount of cryptocurrency mining that can safely occur in a residence? And is there sufficient power reserves in the residential or commercial areas for traditional growth? I think it's fair to say, too, in the most recent rate hearings for cryptocurrency, we've had some testimony from the public that talks about, well, you know, they don't see the problem here. It's just like adding a couple computers in your home. You know, what's the big deal with doing that in residence? So we specifically designed a response to that to help the municipalities and the county understand what is that impact of just a few cryptocurrency machines. So we'll cover that real briefly. I needed a segue for the municipalities to understand what we were dealing with. And so we put this photo together. That's not Eric Walquist running the red light there in the red.
Although I did check when I first saw this. Yeah. I had to make sure that wasn't my license plate.
A little Photoshop there, I could get Eric. In there, I'm sure. In reality, what's important to the municipalities, and transportation, of course, is a big issue that they deal with. You know, the question I asked is, what if they saw, you know, 5 times the amount of traffic on the road system, on the existing road system every day? This is exactly what we're dealing with our electric infrastructure, with the cryptocurrency mining. In some cases, whether it was at the micro level or the macro level, we've seen, you know, 5 times more electrons moving through our systems. That was a really good way for them to understand the challenges that we're dealing with from an infrastructure standpoint. The difference is you can see traffic. You can see congestion. On the electric grid, you know, cables and wires and transformers look the same whether they're heavily loaded or not. So I know this, I'll move through these pretty quickly, but I know our commission understands these concepts because you've seen them and heard them and understood them. But we wanted to draw a relationship to kind of traditional residential load and the cryptocurrency mining machines in the home. So 100-watt light bulb running for an hour, 100-watt hours, right? If you took 10 of those light bulbs, 1,000 watts over an hour, you've got 1,000 watt hours, or we use the term kilowatt hours a lot. Kilo mean 1,000. Over a bill period, 24 hours a day, 30 days in a month, you know, we relate our billing and everything to a 720-hour month. In the Chelan County area, residential services, the average energy consumption is around 1,660 kilowatt hours a month. So let's now relate to the crypto machines themselves. So we'll keep that 1,660 kilowatt hours a month for residential in mind. But if you took those 100-watt light bulbs and you had 12 of them, you'd be running 1,200 watts or 1.2 kilowatt hours. One ASIC server runs, these are probably semi, maybe more of the contemporary servers that you could get today for cryptocurrency mining. One server runs at about 1.2 kW. So it's the equivalent of running the same as 12 100 light bulbs. Now we know the servers run 24/7, and that is where the kilowatt hours start to really build up. So in a residential unit, we got 1,660 kilowatt hours a month. If you had just two cryptocurrency servers in your home, which in my experience, I've never seen just two. They could exist, but if you just ran two, you're running 2,400 watts or 2.4 kilowatts over a 24-hour, you know, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, over that 720 hours. You would consume 1,728 kilowatt hours. Okay, so that's a little bit more than the average residential home, the total energy consumption at home with just two machines. Okay, so it does make a significant difference. It's significantly more than just adding a couple of computers, if you will. I think we've heard some of that testimony. Even just as low as two machines can consume a lot of energy. So more typical is at least 10 cryptocurrency miners in a residential setting. And that's been the experience that I've had. That's what I've witnessed in the field is at least 10 machines running, in some cases, double or triple that in a residential home. Nevertheless, I use this example. If you had 10 ASIC machines, you're running about 8,640 kilowatt hours in a month. And that's more than five times the energy consumption in a residential home. So you can see very quickly how that gives us concern in many aspects. So we use this example. It's just a residential development. You can see the red lines coming in to the green boxes. Those are the transformers on the corner. Many of the transformers share services. You can see the yellow stars are the actual services. Some transformers have two customers. Some have three off of them. This is pretty typical design, what we do in a neighborhood. So in this case, you've got a 15-home residential development. You've got a single feed into that with five transformers serving that, and typical underground residential. If you were to add one traditional cryptocurrency mining operation in one of the homes, the energy consumption then looks like a 20-lot development rather than a 15-lot development. You'd likely have to upgrade or replace at least two of the transformers and reallocate customers to those transformers, new supply cables from the transformers, and perhaps replace some of the primary cable, the red cables coming into the development. So even just one home cryptocurrency mining could be very disruptive to that electric system. That's at the aggregated level. Now we should look at the, you know, the macro level. Within the city of Wenatchee, we've got 10 substations, 10 loaded substations. We've got over 15 miles of transmission and over 200 miles of distribution lines and almost 4,000 distribution transformers. We're providing service to over 15,800 endpoints. And just at face value, you know, we've got greater than $650 million in assets. Now, if you look at that, this particular area down here is our primary industrial and commercial zone. And you can see we've got three transformers and transmission in the yellow serving that. And the other six substations in the area are primarily serving our residential customers. There are some exceptions in there, but primarily serving that greater area and the majority of our meter points. The message here is that if we as a utility are dealing with centralized cryptocurrency loads, meaning crypto loads zoned in the commercial industrial areas, we have a much better opportunity to zero in on that and lessen the impact to the remaining community. We could build substations or transmissions specifically for that centralized load. If we decentralize cryptocurrency and we allow the cryptos to be in any of the zones, including the residential areas, it's likely to have a much greater impact to our infrastructure. We're going to have to build many more substations outside of those traditional industrial commercial areas. We'll have to build new transmission lines, new substations. Decentralization would require us to build new substations in existing neighborhoods, which we all have had many recent experiences trying to site substations in existing neighborhoods. We'll need to run those corresponding transmission lines to feed those substations through those existing neighborhoods, updating existing transformers and feeders. So this is really a big change. This would make a material change to our cost models and, you know, our planning models. So this is the message that we're carrying to the cities, the municipalities, and the county. I think they understand this at that point. We believe that right now there's likely some movement to look towards zoning cryptocurrency specific to industrial commercial areas. The feedback from the City of Wenatchee Planning Commission was that they are very much opposed to zoning cryptocurrency in the residential areas. And we're getting a lot of that same feedback from other stakeholders as well. So the next steps is just to continue the dialogue. And as you can see, we still have several meetings to attend with them. And as I mentioned earlier, it's not our responsibility to set that zoning. It's our responsibility to let them that do understand those impacts. And that's the path that we're on at this point in time. So with that, I can field any questions or wrap it up.
One, when I look at the page that is titled Decentralized, and it shows the future needs if we did that with building out infrastructure, it looks like to me, I know that we, you know, have the available space for Castle Rock.
Castle Rock Substation.
Right. Do we have any other... Do we own any others that are undeveloped?
We own the property at Castle Rock.
Right.
And that property has primarily been allocated for growth in the residential sector. Mr. Chad Risman has got his finger on the trigger for when we need to build that. But it's primarily based around growth and expansion in the residential areas. I think we're getting very close to that need. What's important to recognize is the trigger for that substation may be accelerated as a result of cryptocurrency zoning in the residential areas, as would many others. Just, you know, keep in mind that 1,660 is our average usage, and if every home had two machines, we would more than double our load. For residential sectors, that would mean we would need to double our infrastructure to support that. So the zoning of this is extremely important.
If I remember correctly, Andy, we do not at this point have other land that we have designated for substation sites in the Wenatchee area. We are looking at options because we've been concerned. You've heard us discuss over the course of the last year that we've seen substantial amount of load growth, and we've been looking at substation build out across the county and where that might need to occur. But at this point, beyond Castle Rock, that's the one site that we've got. Is that a that correct?
That is correct, and you are correct. We are turning over every stone we can to try to look at that longer range planning.
And essentially, in layman's terms, Castle Rock is spoken for already.
I would say that's a fair statement. Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
And when we install Castle Rock, what that does is that will relieve some pressure off of Western College and potentially Saddle Rock. Right. So one substation placement relieves a little pressure for growth and expansion, specifically for residential growth and expansion in those substations. Not cryptocurrency. Okay.
One quick question. I think what I'm hearing you say is that the municipalities that you've had an opportunity to chat with so far are sympathetic to the impacts cryptocurrency has within their jurisdiction from a residential perspective is kind of what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary of what the feedback that we're getting. Yeah. They're recognizing the impacts on the electric system, and there's some empathy in terms of creating some proper zoning for that. I think there are still some questions about the value of cryptocurrency in the community as a commerce, as an economic development tool. I've tended to stay away from that, just focused on infrastructure.
Sure.
But there is that growing. That there is that concern for them as well.
Good. That's good to hear. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for your outreach efforts, too. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I just find it really interesting. I'm guessing that they sit up in their chairs when they look at five times the traffic or the impact that a typical neighborhood would have when you put this in their terms and their definitions. It probably really gets their attention. Has that been your experience?
Yes, it has. I mean, our community, our county has enjoyed a very reliable electric system and a system that's had a lot of capacity available in it for many decades. And that enjoyment is coming to an end, right? We are running limited on capacity. So we needed a way to connect, and the transportation analogy was a great way to connect with them. They're getting that.
Yeah, good.
Just from feedback for you and people who, you know, were involved in putting this presentation together, this is just really well done. Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say I think Andy's done a really good job of translating. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ann, please.
Oh, sorry to interrupt.
I just wanted to say that
I think this is a really, really important effort. People are really hungry for more knowledge. They don't understand cryptocurrency. They don't understand the impact. I don't think they understand, sometimes question our motivation. So the more this we can do, get out to, you know, municipalities, the service clubs. I've had a number of different groups say, hey, we'd love to have someone come and talk to us and help us understand this. So I'm just applauding you and your group, Andrew, for doing this. The more of this we do, the better, I think. And I know you do a really good job. I've sat in on a couple meetings. So, yeah, keep it up. Great work.
Thank you.
I just want to add, I think Andy's done a great job of translating into layman's English what the problem is that we're confronting. And you're going to see that this is going to connect to the very next item because we're going to talk some about the impact and how we price for residential mining. And I also want to draw a connection between these planning commissions and others are taking a look at what we're saying. And then we are saying we don't have the authority to say no, but they'll be wondering how we're doing pricing because that is something that's within our control. Mm-hmm. So there's a connection here between the work that Andy is doing and the next conversation we're about to have with respect to pricing. With that.
You guys have dueling mouses.
Yeah. Oh, you're doing this.
It was kind of entertaining to watch, though.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you, Andy.
Lindsay Mons will come up and join us now and talk a little bit about, this is follow-on to clearly the most prevalent comment that we got in public comment was about the impact on small miners. So We have done some additional work to look at just how many of these folks are there, how big of an issue is it, and then want to present the board with some options. We are not making decisions today about what the rate will be. That will come in the formal rate process. But as with our previous discussions, we look to the board for guidance. Do you have thoughts about this that you'd like to share with us as we develop that initial rate proposal? With that, Lindsay.
Good morning, commissioners. So thank you for the great introduction, Steve. I can skip through some of my notes there at the beginning. But yes, we are talking about small mining or residential type mining rate impacts today. This is one of the areas we've been sort of breezing over in our hearings so far, saying that we need to do some further analysis, and today's discussion is that further analysis. We'll talk a little bit about the impact and how many customers currently could be impacted there, with the understanding that we don't know what's coming in the door after the moratorium lifts. So, you know, while we may only have a handful now, we don't know what the next days would bring. We'll talk about the rate considerations for those residential customers and next steps. As we develop rates, we always seek board feedback and direction as we work through these, balancing board philosophies and whatnot. So there's no action required today, but we are interested in feedback today or at the next hearing as we go forward. So first off, talking a little bit about our existing cryptocurrency connections. These are our customers that are currently online and operating or authorized to operate. This is a chart of their authorized KWs, so their peak demand. The first bit there in kind of a blue-green is those connected since January 1st of 2017. That was the date that our HDL rate went into effect. So we have just really a pretty small volume of customers there, or magnitude, I guess, about a half a megawatt, and nine customers. Within this group, there's maybe a handful of residential services. And that's the only group we see residential services in at this point. The others that were connected prior to January 1st or prior to the HDL effort, in the green and kind of orange, are not in residential areas, and represent a little over a megawatt for those that don't have rate contracts and almost 9 megawatts for those that do. And just as a reminder, those rate contracts were agreed to rate phase in for those customers that had made significant infrastructure investments prior to our HDL effort. So all in total, there's about 10.5 megawatts here of authorized cryptocurrency load. We also have cryptocurrency applications currently on hold. And of those applications that are less than 5 megawatts, we have about 16.5 megawatts requested in 20 applications. About half of those applications, but representing a bulk of the capacity, or 15 megawatts, are in areas that we've previously presented as having limited capacity. So while we have 16.5 megawatts of application, it's unlikely that we would be able to authorize 16.5 megawatts of connections. But each of those applications will need further analysis once the moratorium lifts and we begin reprocessing those. We'll look at the capacity at the substations they've requested, and what other infrastructure improvements are required prior to knowing who and how much can connect.
So, just a question, you know, going back one slide. Mm-hmm. The 10.5 megawatts for crypto, is our average daily use around 189 to 200 megawatts locally in that neighborhood? Okay.
Our annual
that helps me understand.
Average megawatts of energy.
Yeah, the percentage increase.
Let me just make sure, though. That's average megawatts of energy, and these are peak numbers?
These are peak numbers.
So our average daily, or our peaks, there is no average daily, our peaks are in the 450 to 500 range during the highest season. Now, the unique thing about these is that they tend to run flat out most of the time. So is that correct, Lindsay?
Yes.
There is both a megawatt number here. There's an energy number that's a little bit smaller than this, but because they're running most of the time, then you get close to 100% load factor. So it's only a small difference between the peak and the energy component.
So about 5% increase
in the
crypto over our former, and I understand the explanation. I'm just trying to get head around about 5% higher now with crypto than we were before crypto moved in these illustrations?
Likely, if we were to look back at history, of course, those peaks are influenced by many other things, like particularly weather.
Sure.
Is a big peak influencer in this area.
As an energy component, though, that's about right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'd be about a 5% increase.
Well, I have one question while we're still on this slide, so clarification. You said that in the residential users now are in that first kind of blue-gray area,
yes.
And there are 9 users. Are we saying that all 9 of those are in a residential?
They are not.
So how many of those 9 then do we have that are currently in a residential?
We think about half.
About half. So 4.5, 5. And that would be of all the crypto users right now, or crypto miners, I guess, 4 or 5 of them would be in a residential area.
Yeah. Okay. And it really depends on what we settle on as the definition of residential area,
sure.
Which is something we're still looking for the easiest way for customers to understand and for us to apply.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Of those that have identified themselves to us as well.
Right. Yeah. They're still the outlaws. Yeah.
Or outliers.
Within the applications on hold, we have a similar, just small handful in the residential area, so similar volume as our existing customers. But again, this is something that we should talk about because we've heard so much interest about people doing residential mining that we want to make sure that we have a rate that's reflective of the impact that has to our infrastructure, our cost, and everything else. So just a little information from where we've been. The background of this slide is the slide we've been talking through at our various rate hearings that talks about kind of the average costs that we've been calculating for cryptocurrency, both in kind of the part that's covered up is the commercial industrial type areas. But the top portion in yellow for discussion today is the section on residential services. We've talked about recommending an adjusted delivery charge. And of course, all of the different groups, we had recommended an increase in the basic charge, and that results for residential customers in a cost of 7 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And the breakdown of that from our cost analysis is the customer cost is, you know, about a fifth of a penny. So it's very small on a per kWh basis. The residential area delivery cost is about 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour, and the market energy estimate is about 5.1 cents currently, for all in of about 8.1 cents. The 7 to 10 cent range came from the market variability portion of the discussion. As we look at these rates or these costs, the next step in the rate design is to do a rate design. So taking the per kWh numbers and converting those into how we bill. So a basic charge on a per monthly basis, delivery charge on a per kWh, so their peak monthly demand, and then the market energy just stays as per kWh. So when we take those charges, do the rate design, we come up with the center here in red is our residential zone cryptocurrency rate design. And this is informed by cost as well as board philosophies that have been put forth in the past. So cost recovery, efficient use of resources, those types of things, impact to customers, all those come into play when we do rate design. This table just gives some information. The first column there is the existing HDL rate, so that's where all the cryptocurrency customers have been to date as far as rates go. The new residential zone cryptocurrency is the recommended $900 a month and $11 in demand, and then the energy charge. And then the non-residential zone cryptocurrency also at $900 a month and $550 demand, which is the same as existing HDL, and then the energy charge at 5.1. So when we take the next step in analyzing this and really looking at impact to customers, which is where a lot of the comments that we've heard in public session have come, looking at what this means to a small residential miner, we did find that there are challenges for those very small miners and those with low load factors. What creates a low load factor in a cryptocurrency mine is those that maybe have 5 or 10 miners operating in their house. So they have kind of a base all on all the time type cryptocurrency load. But on top of that, they also have their variable home load. So they have their dryer running and their oven and things, you know, throughout the day that impact their cost as well. And this results in a higher than anticipated per kWh value when we take the proposed rates and apply them to customers. So I've got two scenarios here for you. Scenario A, a small mining in-home 90 or 30 kW, but at the high load factor we typically see for cryptocurrency around 90%. At our existing HDL rates, this calculates into a bill of about $820 and an average per kWh of 4.2 cents. At the new recommended rate, at the bottom of the table there, let's see, down here, you see that their bill more than doubles and their calculated rate goes up over 11 cents per kilowatt hour. When we take a similar peak, so the same 30 kW peak, but a lower load factor, 57%, which is at the very low end of what we're seeing of those residential cryptocurrency mining operations, that rate goes from $600+ a month at about 5 cents a kilowatt hour, and it triples, so up to 15 cents a kilowatt hour, which is greater than what we anticipated or what was planned in our rate design. But it is reflective of cost. So the rate design that we performed really had that focus in mind. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about a little more background on that rate design and how it all works and another option that we have. So the first portion is the basic charge. So that's the $900 a month. When we look at basic charges, we look at costs, things like the cost of metering, the cost of billing and collections, customer services, and then some other general costs like you and I, the cost of our salaries get allocated across customers. So with a basic charge, we can take this pot of costs and we can allocate it in several different ways. And the way that we've proposed allocating in this case is giving each customer an equal amount. So every customer in the class, regardless of size, would be assessed the $900 a month. The other option, which is really the approach that was taken on the HDL rate, is to allocate that at a certain portion by size. So as the customer increases in size, they get a higher allocation of that cost, which results in a tiered approach to that rate. So those really are the options, the first one being $900. And the reason that staff proposed this option was really because we are seeing those customers take at least a similar or greater amount of time. The small customers taking at least as much time as the larger customers. So allocating that across seemed fair from that perspective. We do understand that it is very costly, though. So option two, if we were to instead of focusing on cost recovery as our the philosophy, board philosophy driving our rate design here, if instead we wanted to focus on the customer service or impact to customers, some of those other things, another option would be to go back to setting the basic charge the same as the HDL class currently is. I'll pause there. Any questions before we move on to delivery? Okay. So on the delivery side of things, we had another challenge at hand. You saw this map from Andy's presentation just a few minutes ago. And as he discussed, our existing transmission and substation system, if you look at the map, is largely in our commercial industrial areas. So the downtown core of Wenatchee, up along Western and the college, Miller Street to the hospital, you know, those are really kind of the areas where we see commercial industrial customers. So the amount of infrastructure that it takes to get power from those substations and lines to those customers is smaller than if we had to, or I shouldn't say have to because it is there, than the infrastructure that is installed to get power out to all the residential customers. It just takes a lot more infrastructure. So our cost to deliver to those commercial industrial areas is about 1 cent per kilowatt hour. Whereas in the residential area, as I mentioned before, we're really almost three times that at 2.8 cents per kilowatt hour. When we take this per kilowatt hour cost and move it into a design, a rate design on a per kW or demand basis, we do have to make some assumptions about the load factor of the customer. So when we looked at option one, which is the rate proposal, initial rate proposal, the $11 per kilowatt hour, because we focused so much on cost recovery in the basic charge, in this charge, we considered more of the customer impact side of things and made the assumptions on the low end of the cost structure. So the $11 would be kind of the minimum cost for a residential customer at the 55% load factor. If we were to flip those and wanted to, say, take option two on the basic charge where we consider those customer impacts on the basic charge and then instead look at cost recovery on the delivery charge, we would take a more average residential area load factor. So 74% is our average residential mining load factor, which represents kind of the greater overall distribution system impact of those. So that increases the basic charge to $15 per kW. And as Andy mentioned in his presentation, as we see the municipalities and county move forward with their plans, if they do any zoning or anything like that, that will additionally limit or decrease our risk in these areas as well. So, you know, delivery charge can be kind of confusing. Are there any questions? So energy charge rate design is what it is because it's calculated and billed on a per kWh basis. It's really just based on the customer's consumption. This is the estimated forward market price of 5.1 cents. It's made up of market energy, green energy adders, risk, and administration. We have heard, though, from those small customers that there is a big concern about the market volatility because, if you remember, we've proposed this rate be variable based on what the market is at the moment, so or on a monthly basis. Additionally, those small residential customers are less likely to be able to secure that third-party mitigation that we've talked about in the public hearings. So one of the options or an option here with the energy rate is to set it at a value periodically, so there's some predictability for the customers in that rate, and we can adjust that based on what we're seeing in actual cost to the district. So if that's a direction the board is interested in, we can certainly.
So what you're saying is you're trying to address the what's been shared as a concern, trying to address that and level that off a little bit.
Right.
Okay.
So, Lindsay, wouldn't that shift the risk of market price volatility to the district?
It would. But if we're just talking about small customers or residential class customers, the amount of risk or the dollar volume of risk is less. And we can adjust, as we adjust that monthly rate, account for impacts in the past as well. So cost recovery from previous months or kind of in that how that's designed.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that doesn't preclude us from augmenting that rate as needed.
So taking kind of the option one, option two rates into the analysis. So option one is the current proposal, which I talked about at the beginning, that results in the 11 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour. If we move to an option two, or if the board's interested in a second option here, with the basic charge that's set at the HDL rate, so for this size, it would be $130 a month, the $15 demand charge, and then continue with the same 5.1 cent energy, which is what we anticipate it to be at this time, it brings it into the 8 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. So, and really just the difference in these is one's not necessarily right and the other necessarily wrong. It's just different board philosophies, so different directions or different balance of philosophies. As we work through rate design, the philosophies naturally contradict, and that's one of the big art pieces of making rates is how do you balance cost recovery with customer impact with incremental changes over time and all of the other elements. So this would be one area that
Say a bit more about the philosophy underlying option one and the philosophy underlying option two, going back to our rate principles.
Yeah, so under option one, this was is largely based in cost recovery and revenue predictability for the district. So looking at the full cost recovery on customer or basic charges and having that set every month is predictable for the district. So we know we're going to get that revenue to cover our cost on a monthly basis. Under option two, the basic charge is tiered. So these customers would pay potentially less of the cost of service than another customer, a larger customer. But with the demand charge, we've kind of changed the focus there to be more cost recovery and demand. So option two is really more of a customer impact sort of philosophy, the customer's ability to impact their bill. So as they monitor their demand, or if a residential customer wants to start controlling their bill a little more, you know, maybe not run the dryer and the heater and the dishwasher all at the same time, you know, they can start kind of managing their load to control their bills as well. So
thank you.
You're welcome. So beyond just rate design, one other item we had for discussion and feedback today is really in rate implementation. As you all know, there's a big customer information system or software system update going on right now in our customer accounting group, which creates some challenges as far as developing new rates. It's nearly impossible to reprogram that system at this point because we are kind of mid-conversion. So any immediate implementation of rates would require manual billing, which we could certainly do, but just for awareness, there is a cost and complexity to that. Other implementation options that we have are to delay the implementation either in whole or in part until April 2020, which would be post-CIS implementation. That project is expected to be done in early 2020, so this would give the time for programming and testing of the rate prior to implementation in April. Plus, April's a good time to change rates anyways because we're through the kind of winter season. So that's typically when we see higher bills. Coming into spring, you know, the impact is less for that time of year. So we could do either wait entirely until April, but implement things like the upfront charge now so that we take care of kind of that bigger infrastructure portion and then take care of the rest of the rate in 2020, or we could probably do some sort of a partial implementation if we just change one item like the energy element within the existing system. Instead of having to recreate a whole new rate, we could update the energy probably and avoid the manual billing portion. We also have options that we could explore for those who have made substantial investments, similar to as we did with the HDL effort. Looking for those customers that have, say, built facilities or things under the understanding of previous rates and charges.
I want to take a moment and underscore this first point because I think it's really important. In fact, we're going to give you a bit of an update later in manager's items and how the customer information system is coming along, but this is a very big effort at the district. It is a significant reputational risk for us is putting in place a new customer information system. It's the one thing we touch customers on every month is the minimum bill. And other utilities have had a lot of challenges in putting new CIS into effect. So very much concerned, putting a lot of effort into this. The idea of adding more of a burden on top of that with the manual billing is a concern to us. So something we would like for you to take into account is just how do we manage putting in place new rates for cryptocurrency miners at the same time as we're managing new billing systems for everyone across the district.
Okay. So those are really the residential services rate and then the rate implementation options are two kind of open items that we would be looking for feedback on prior to or during the next hearing. The larger cryptocurrency rates, we really haven't received any negative feedback from the public, so we're nor the board. So we are continuing with that original proposal on non-residential. So that's where we are with that. And then so our next hearing is at the next board meeting in September 17th.
So to summarize, think about this as two options for pricing. Both of which I think as staff we can support. Again, using the principles that the board has given us in the past for guidance. And then a phase-in option that can apply to either of the options.
Commissioners, I believe that staff is really looking for us to give them feedback today so they can come back to us on the 17th. With a solid proposal. And so I'd like to entertain your thoughts at this point so that there's some kind of understanding individually what we may be thinking.
Well, I'm just going to thank you for the presentation. That was a lot to take in.
Yes.
And personally, myself, I feel like I just sat through 101 cryptocurrency rate setting, and I need 102. I need some tutorial, some additional time understanding this and what those options are for billing and So I guess that's what I'm asking for, is I feel like I need some additional learning, some additional instruction before September 17th.
So you're looking for a one-on-one opportunity?
Probably.
Okay. Mr. Reznov?
Harken back to what Andy said earlier when he was sharing with us what he was hearing through outreach. And bullet point number three on that list was that cryptocurrency mining is an industrial commercial use of electricity. And so I'm having a difficult time relating to residential. Here we are talking about residential rates when what we're hearing back from most of our municipal partners is a definition that pretty clearly outlines it as an industrial commercial use of electricity. And I start thinking about, you know, if people were going to start to smelter aluminum in their home, you know, we had a high use arrangement with Alcoa, where do we draw the line? And so my gut tells me that the if this definition holds up, that cryptocurrency mining is defined as an industrial commercial use, that there should be rates that reflect the demand and stress placed upon our designed residential grid that is being used in a manner for which the grid was not designed and stretching capacity as a result of that. So my feeling, and I'm with Commissioner McKenna, I'd like to have some more one-on-one time to really dive into this and back test what my gut tells me I'm feeling. But if we're really talking about four or five residential cryptocurrency miners now, and I don't know what the future would bring with respect to additional residential cryptocurrency miners. I think that those miners who are, let's not forget, what they're doing is they're in a business to make money, that they should be responsible for ensuring the electrical grid system for others in their neighborhood against failure based upon their oversized use of power. So that's just kind of my gut feel at this point, that there has to be a standard of, if you're going to use the power and if you're going to make a profit off the power and it's somehow going to damage or tax the residential structure of your electric grid, then you should be made responsible for making sure that doesn't happen. That's my gut feel. But I would really value one-on-one time to understand better what it is I'm saying. But that's what my gut's telling me.
For example, one of the questions I have, and probably needs to be answered on this one-on-one time, is, so deciding whether to continue the moratorium or not, and we're talking about, you know, I think I've heard that in the industrial areas there are things that we can do under the HDL load, and people have stepped up to the plate and paid their way, and we're handling that. In the residential area, you know, we're talking about rates, but is it appropriate to continue the moratorium based upon letting the cities and counties catch up to speed with us in their decisions and planning practices before we take steps that say, here's the rate that we're providing in residential areas? It seems like we're still ahead of the game here, and it appears to me a moratorium to continue letting municipalities catch up is that appropriate? And maybe that's a question that somebody can help me answer.
So I can tell you that if the board believes that to be the appropriate step, then it would be appropriate. And by that I mean there's not a restriction that would say you could not do that. It really would be a board decision.
But we could not have a sustained moratorium.
Well, you would need to tie it to a date certain. Right? And yeah. I understand the commissioner's point, which is if it's not going to be permitted in residential areas, and Lindsay mentioned during her presentation, I don't know if you caught it, but how we define residential in terms of their zoning compared against our infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Those may not perfectly align, but they may. And so, yeah, certainly one could ask, why are we setting a rate somewhere where they may not allow it? And we also don't know, though, that would be the outcome across all of the municipalities. So we could take a wait and see if the board preferred, or we can move ahead or modify the moratorium in any fashion that you all see fit.
I would say there would likely be a workload impact from that, because I would assume if the proposal was to continue the moratorium for the residential alone, then we would proceed with a rate proposal for commercial and industrial.
Yes.
And we would, so there's a rate process that we'll be discussing at the next board meeting,
yeah,
public comment, et cetera. So, and we would put that rate into effect. Then we would come back and at some point in the future need to come up with a rate for the residential, so there'd be a second rate process.
Right. Then.
So there's a just an impact in terms of the workload.
Can I jump in here?
Go ahead, please, Ann.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, there's a lot to consider here. With respect to, I don't know if it was Gary's comment or Steve's comment, that possibly we should wait and extend the moratorium and give the municipalities, the cities, and so forth a chance to catch up. That's from one commissioner's perspective, that's too open-ended. I mean, that could be a year. That could be a year and a half. And we need to keep moving this forward and make a decision and give some certainty to, you know, to the folks who are waiting to move forward on this. So I struggle with that a little bit. and then I just wanted to make a comment. I mean, I have a lot more reading and a lot more understanding to do on this as well. But my comment is that I appreciate, I appreciate Lindsay's and staff's approach bringing us options, you know, options in price, options in how we approach it, you know, whether we phase this in, because I don't want to have, you know, a definite hard and fast guidance from the commissioners to staff, and then staff having a, you know, kind of a set in stone a recommendation before we go back out to the public, because then it looks like we're just doing, you know, it looks like we're just going out because we have to. So I want to give some guidance, but I also feel personally that we need to give some guidance, but not any definitive numbers and so forth, so we can take options to the public and listen to them and hear what they have to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Ann. Mr. Rosen, I think you had a comment.
No, that's fine.
Okay. Time for me to weigh in. I appreciate the opportunity for my colleagues to speak first. It's probably going to be no shock that I'm looking for a little bit more certainty in a decision. When I look at the best for the most for the longest, we've got 48,000 other customers, and I'm feeling very little support from them to continue the moratorium in the process. I think people are looking, as well as the residential miners, et cetera, to end the moratorium. And so my advocacy would be on the 17th to do that. So that's pretty specific. There's going to be a natural delay in there because we could go back. We could go with the current structure, which we're involved in. And the delay to April for the CIS gives staff and everyone else a chance to solidify. It also would give municipals a chance to respond. I agree with Commissioner Congdon that when you get into what the communities may do in terms of zoning, is a little bit like asking how long is a piece of string. It's going to be whatever they decide and whenever they decide to decide, if they decide to decide. So we have no control over that process. So I think we need to be able to execute what it is that we can execute. It's kind of an interesting proposition because I hear residential miners and they're small and they have concerns, and I get that. I mean, I really do. But they're looking for certainty on both ends. They would like a price that allows them to continue to mine, but I also look at the price of Bitcoin from August 20th till today, and it's gone up $1,000. So now if we could share that $1,000 with them, I might feel a little bit better about having a different structure. But we're in an uncertain electrical market. We have to have some flexibility in that market over time to adjust. We don't know what the natural gas prices are going to be. That's the driver. We don't know what other projects may affect our ability to have the rates that we have now. And so we have to have built into the process that ability to go back and restructure our rates to at least put in front of the other 48,000 people who have a little or no interest in mining in their homes the opportunity that someone is their guardian, someone is looking for their interest. So my thoughts kind of run, I would look at scenario A as a starting point and allow us over time to move toward scenario B with the consideration that we have to manage a fluctuating market. So that's a little bit more certainty, but been ruminating on this now for, 9 months? It's time. So that's where one commissioner is. Other thoughts from my commissioners now that I'm going to lay that out? Yeah.
It sounds like you all are well aware, but for everyone else in the room, just clarification, because I don't think I said it very clearly, that even if we delayed full implementation of the rate to 2020, that doesn't mean that we have to keep the moratorium in place till 2020. So we could lift the moratorium earlier, apply the new upfront charges, and apply existing or a step towards the final rate in the interim before April 2020.
Thank you. That's helpful.
And there's some mix and match here, too, as to do we immediately go to the upfront charges for new miners as opposed to adopting the rate, but because the upfront charges are relatively easy to manage from an administrative standpoint, the rate takes more work associated with it. So this is why we were looking for just some general guidance about your instincts about this, because we can mix and match a number of things here. We also have the opportunity to talk about that during the rate process as well. We'll put a proposal out. People will respond to it. We'll get public comments. There'll be an opportunity to hear how people feel about different elements of the proposal.
So is mine too high of a level of specificity, or are we okay?
Oh, I think it's fine.
Okay. Actually,
in fact, this conversation is just what we were hoping for, trying to get a sense of where you're at.
So my only observation in its response to your September 17th expectation would be that we really wouldn't be in a position to come out of the moratorium until we have a rate. On the 17th, the proposal was that we would bring more information, and under the new rate setting resolution that you heard from Kathy about last meeting and adopted, staff would bring you a plan for outreach as part of that rate action. And then after that is complete and the board determines what the appropriate rate would be, we would make, I anticipate, a rate decision. The board would, and at that point in time, there would be action on the moratorium.
Okay. And through those rate actions, there are public settings.
Correct.
Outreach. And I'm guessing we do have to go to a hearing at some point to adopt the rate.
Yeah, it will be a public hearing following the outreach.
Right. So
we are planning to bring back to you on the 17th the proposal for how to conduct the outreach activities consistent with the way we've redesigned the rate setting process. So it's really a board decision as to what's the right level of outreach.
Commissioners, any additional thoughts or direction that we could provide for staff?
My sense of it is that the limitation here is the implementation of the CIS system, which holds us back from establishing that new rate and implementing it. However, if we can charge that upfront rate without having the CIS system in place, I would be in favor. I think, and the reason I say that is that the demand on the system is real and current, and to the extent that we can recapture some of that risk for our 48,000 other ratepayers, I think we should.
And I think it's important for me to say, although I at least appear to be fairly comfortable with where we are, and what I said this morning, I absolutely support commissioners individually meeting with staff to find that level of comfort where they are and be able to articulate that, in future meetings and with support and encourage those one-on-ones to take place.
Dennis, I just have one last comment.
Sure, please, Ann.
Thanks. I just wanted to say to Lindsay, staff, to Steve Wright, that I appreciate their concern about fairness and equity. I'm pretty sure all of us commissioners have that same concern about fairness and equity. So I see that. I really see that throughout all the discussions, all the analysis, and the options they're bringing forward. So thanks for that.
I think the process has been very, very transparent, and which is an overworked word right now. But I do think it's important, and I'm continuing to support that, what we're doing and how we're doing it. So, again, Ann, thanks for bringing that up. Other thoughts? Enough information?
It's been great. Thank you.
All right.
And I'll work with Rebecca to get some of those meetings set up.
Yeah, and what's been great, though, Lindsay, is everyone in staff bringing us options. Just real quick, every now and then you get buttonholed. You guys have a lot of 5-0 votes or 4-1 or, you know. But people, I don't think, realize, and they usually try and take the time to understand how long and how much information we get over time to make those decisions. And it's very, very much appreciated. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll pass it on.
We there?
We're good with the morning, but with a few minutes left, if you don't mind, I'd like to capture a couple of our manager items just to use our time. I was going to do that last.
Okay. Well, this is the last.
Okay. John Stoll's got a couple items, I think. Okay.
Morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Mark is setting up just a big picture overview of the current customer information system. Notice there's quite a bit of synergy in the topics we've had this morning, so this is a good opportunity to just kind of tie in where we're at. It's hard to believe, but we're a third of the way through the project. As we've chatted, these are pretty complex, pretty challenging implementations. We do a lot. We've got a lot of different customer classes, rates. Our customer information system does a lot of functions. The one we've had in place has served us very well, but as we've chatted before, it's out of support and it's time to be updated. So we're currently going through the Oracle C2M product, which is the next generation successor to the PeopleSoft system we have. So again, the good news is it's a third of the way through. The project, in my opinion, has gone very well, although as Mark will allude to, we're entering into a new phase, what I would call the pick and shovel, the really get into it, a lot of testing, training, configuration, all the work that's gone into this date now starts getting designed and implemented, and that's the next phase of it. Just kind of an overview, this is my second rodeo with a CIS system. I was pretty young in my career when we did the first one. This one has gone very well with your support. We've got a great steering committee. It's a lot of the senior managers are focused on this. We have monthly meetings that Mark and our implementer leads. We have also hired a quality assurance person who kind of is a look over the shoulder and reports on us. Right now we're doing that quarterly, but as the project ramps up into this next phase, we will see that being more frequently. And lastly, I'm very very supportive of having Mark. He's been a really steady hand on the tiller as we've moved this project forward. He brings a tremendous amount of experience and common sense to the effort. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mark.
Thanks, John. I'm going to touch on maybe two primary things. One, just a quick overview of the project, kind of where it's been, where it's going. So with that, like John said, third of the way through, the first phase of this project is really what we call the analysis phase. And so we do a lot of review of the requirements, how we're going to configure, install the system. We actually extended that slightly to make sure we had covered all the components related to this new application. And that's coming to a tail end here this month in September. At the same time, we're gearing up some design work related to how we're going to connect this to other systems, how we're going to build maybe enhancements, produce reports, et cetera, that need to be developed as part of the deployment of this system. The next phase, as John noted, is kind of all those things coming together, and we actually start configuring and designing and developing all the solutions. So we're kind of done talking and laying the groundwork for the system, but actually putting it in place, finalizing how we're going to bring the existing data from the existing system into the new system, finalizing configurations, finalizing the development of any interfaces with other third-party applications, as well as other applications at the district. So that's going to occur over the next 3 to 6 months. We've got a lot of technical support. A lot of this work is being done internally by IT. So they're developing most of those customized solutions with support from Blue Heron, our third-party consultant, who's primarily focused on helping us configure the system and bring the existing data from our existing system into the new system. As you can see, we get to the tail end of the project. It's full of a lot of testing. So also in the second phase, we'll be doing testing. But as we get into the third phase, It's really, you know, testing the system, making sure all the configurations, everything we developed works appropriately under any kind of scenario we can think of. We actually moved to the build simulation. So we're actually going to go through three different cycles of simulating that entire system and comparing it to our existing system. And that's a long, drawn-out process. Ultimately, moving to user acceptance, the UAT, as defined on the summary sheet, is really the user acceptance testing. That's when we sign off on does it meet all the requirements that we've identified up front. Finally, we actually go out and train the remaining staff so everyone's competent and familiar with the new system. And so there's kind of a seamless transition. This transition happens overnight. And so we'll practice at least three times going live with the system, which takes an entire week. And sometimes maybe the first one might take even longer. One of the goals is to condense that time frame down to a weekend so we can come in, convert over to the new system, show up on that Monday or Tuesday, and be ready to go with the new system, everybody trained and ready to go. So that's kind of a quick overview of the project, kind of where we're at, where we're going. I'll touch on also kind of the impacts that relate to your discussions earlier today related to crypto currency in particular. As you can identify, we spent a lot of time discussing over five months of how we're going to implement the system. As we start finalizing those designs and developing things, we initiate testing. And so that's the critical point where once we get to that, if we start changing the rules, the new system, the existing system, or changing how we're going to do rates, or how we're going to have the system handle certain processes, it takes us back kind of to square one. And so if we've already tested it and validated the testing and we have to go back and reconfigure it, it requires us to retest and potentially even retrain. So if we've trained people to understand the configurations and how things are designed, once we go back in time, it just defers that process. It extends the scope potentially and the schedule of the project. So that's the critical point in time, and that's why it's critical to factor in this project related to other policy changes. Just to put it in context, a month of this project costs about $500,000. So if we do extend this scope of this project out time-wise with additional resources, the dollars add up pretty fast. And you'll see a lot of utilities where their projects have doubled in cost. There's a lot of money going into these on a monthly basis. And usually if you have to reset the targeted go-live date, you're usually setting it out 2 or 3 months because it takes a while just to kind of reset that expectation. So that's a high-level review of kind of where we're at. I think what John said, the project's going really well. We're extremely happy with our third-party consultants, Blue Heron. They're doing a great job and applying a lot of resources. I would note that the district internally has put in over 6,000 hours of time, which is led by Kerry Wendell's group, as well as in the IT, Ken and Alex Smith areas. So a lot of resources being applied, and those are only getting to be increased over the next 3 to 6 months as we continue to move forward with the project. So that was a quick update.
Do we have an estimated cost per date?
To date?
Yeah.
We spent just shy of $2
million. Okay.
The total project cost, I believe, is about $8
million.
And okay. So we're about a quarter of the way through the spending of that, but again, we're getting into expectation of higher spending over the next 3 to 6 months.
Right. So somewhere 11, 12? No,
it'll be around 8.
Just ignore the fact I asked that question.
Okay.
Yeah, because that's, no.
We're endeavoring hard to stick to the budget.
Right, I appreciate it. Yeah, that would be an unfair question. I really don't want to ask.
I would like to point out, again, this has been a really helpful group effort. Kelly's group and the IET group, they're dedicated to this. Carrie's been a magician in how she's structured her staff, and she's going to need to do more of that as we get into that testing mode. So it's really all hands on deck over the next, less than a year.
Okay. Commissioners, comments, questions?
Just a quick note. I want to say thanks to Mark because in order to get to automated metering infrastructure, we have to have CIS. We're now working to try to bring the AMI request for proposal forward toward the end of this year, and that's Mark working with both those projects. So doing a really nice job of recognizing that we have to integrate these efforts in order to be successful.
So I guess as part of my ongoing individual training on cryptocurrency, I need to further understand the impact that our decisions are having on this project. So I want to be helpful, and I want to understand that. And thank you.
Okay.
Good job. It's you've got a lot of moving parts, and you're doing a great job at keeping them all together.
Commissioner Congdon?
No, thank you. I'm good.
You're welcome. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. By the way, don't eat dessert at lunch. We're having some cake later as a celebration. So,
we have one last item for this morning's meeting, and I would like to have Kelly Boyd come see us right over here. I love it when Kelly has an expression of what? I'm not in control. Look on her face. Kelly, you got to understand what a privilege this is. Many of you know that our relationship is at least 30 years old. Kelly has been with the PUD. Thank you. Kelly has been with the PUD 25 years. You have served us in so many different capacities. And as CFO, when the organization hits the top five out of about 3,300, pretty good high water mark. And so extremely proud of you, the job, your staff, the way you work with your staff. And I wish you luck for the next 25.
And you surprised me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So appreciate you.
Thank you.
And what you do. And I think that's it for the morning.
It is it for the morning.
All right, we'll be back at 1. Good afternoon, and calling Chelan County Board of Directors into our business session. The afternoon, it's 101. And we have three commissioners present at the table, and Commissioner Congdon, you're on the line. She is. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ann, very much. We will start with our consent agenda. Tell me what your desires are, please.
I would move to approve the consent agenda as stated.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as stated. any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Disapproval would be no. Motion is carried. So, on with the regular agenda, item 13.
So we committed to bring you back lessons learned, and we have a couple that relate to the consent agenda. Brett Pickford's going to tell us about those.
Yes, I have several I'd like to discuss. The first one is with regard to the resolution for final acceptance of contract 1575, and that was for the Holly Street Shop 20-ton bridge crane. And so that lessons learned was having the option to be able to negotiate contracts is very valuable, to be able to match scope with budget. And so the background to that is that we bid that project twice, and we were able to... unable to receive responsive bids.
Hello?
Hi, sorry, I lost you.
Thank you.
Even though we did have mandatory pre-bid meetings, we had multiple addendums, we were unable to get contractors to be able to either not have exceptions to our terms and conditions or come in with pricing that was in within 15% of the engineer's estimate. And so through the negotiation process, we were able to match a scope and a value with what they were able to provide. And so some of the examples were that were in their bid proposals, they had proposed about $10,000 to do the crane rail survey, which gave us the spacing of the crane rails and whether they were in alignment. Once we learned what that cost was and what the risks they thought that undertook, we said we would take that on, and we were able to do it for about $1,500 so that could come out of the scope. The other one was removal of the existing crane. And again, we negotiated with multiple vendors, and so that average cost was about $40,000. And then once we worked through what some of the shop folks could do, what engineering could do, we got that price down to about $18,000. Another example was disposal of the existing crane. All of them kept excluding disposing the existing crane. because we didn't have as-built drawings. We knew it had some lead. It was from the 1940s. It was repurposed from another facility. And so after it was all said and done, we were able to actually work out with the American Equipment that they would take it for free. So those are a lot of discussions that individual contractors with different restrictions with insurance and other things with their own capabilities, once you can work that through a negotiating process, helps you to get to a reasonable cost. We had costs ranging in their bids from $250,000 up to $750,000, and we really only had a budget and had a value for a crane that was more like the $180,000 to $190,000. And so it actually took, this took like a whole year to actually work out, but having that option through our RCWs and with the commission granting us that authorization to do that, that helped us finally get a solution to that need for a new crane. The next one is for acceptance of the work for contract 1779 with Captone Structures for water meters. And with that one, we had some changes, and those changes were related to site conditions changing related to as-built drawings. And so out in the East Bank Aquifer, where we had these changes, we have four 20-inch water mains. And so within there, we had to put these water meters. And on one of them, we had looked at the drawings, and it said we had a long enough straight run of pipe to put the meter in. And once they did the excavation, it was much shorter. So then we had to make some changes to get enough straight pipe to make the meter respond accurately. So not that we wouldn't have had the extra work to maybe do, but through that process of having correct drawings, we can plan it, and then the execution can go much faster, because it took several weeks to work out what are we going to do, how are we going to solve that problem, should we dig up someplace else. And so it's good to have as-builts that are correct. The second one was, the next one is for contract 1821. Again, that's an acceptance of work with Smith Excavation for East Peter Street and Knowles Road water line main replacement. And that one just had a minor change, but again, it was coordinating the city's wastewater, stormwater system with our piping, and so there were some as-builts that weren't there that we had to take some time to resolve, but not a big dollar value for that one. And so those are the lessons learned I have to present.
Great.
I just have to say one thing. Wow. Good job on the crane and the negotiation and engineering working your way through that. I know it took you time to do, but what a dollar cost savings. That's fabulous. Yeah. Great job.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Good work.
Any other comments? Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Much appreciated. So we are at 14?
We are 14, yeah.
All right.
This is a resolution clarifying the general manager authority under forward transaction for purchase and sale electric energy and capacity with electricity end users. And actually, Eric is going to help me here because we modified the title to this last week. And, of course, I didn't make it on the agenda until this morning. So.
Yeah, I apologize, commissioners, for that. You did receive the correct resolution in your packet over the weekend. It just had an old title in the agenda. So we've actually corrected that online so that people can, if they come on, they'll see not only the resolution that's posted and was correct, but a corresponding title in the agenda that's also correct and reflective. And the primary change, in fact, the only change was really that the title carries the words end user, and what we've substituted is non-traditional market participants in the formal resolution to give ourselves a little, I'll say, less specificity in trying to interpret what end users mean, such that we might be hampered or hindered later.
More flexibility.
Yeah.
So Greg Carrington will describe this more.
Hi, Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources, and this is really a clarification of Resolution 11-13687, and that is the one we affectionately call our hedging program. It allows us to go out there and sell energy on a five-year forward basis. In that resolution, it's really clear that we're allowed to go out there and sell to marketing companies and other utilities. The one thing that isn't clear is more of an evolution of the energy market itself. Now we're getting corporate buyers that are out there looking for energy from us, and we are also getting what's called consumer choice associations or advocates, and they're looking to buy power from us in the future as well. So we thought it would be better for us to come here to clarify that the language that we typically associate with that resolution is better and clearer if we add that term, the non-traditional market participants. And I think I may come back to you with further clarifications in the future because the energy market is changing every day, right? I mean, it's just an evolving thing as we get into the California market and so forth.
Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions?
You're right. It's changing a lot and fast. So, yeah. Appreciate you guys staying on top of it terminology-wise.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Item 15.
This is a proposed motion to increase the capital project budget for the Peshaston Wastewater Treatment Facility improvements from 4.1 to 4.86 million. And Ron Slabaugh, David Lodge will be presenting. Recall that we discussed this at a previous meeting and we had received bids and you had authorized us to go out and negotiate. So there will be reporting back on that.
Thank you, Steve. So since a month ago when we asked to reject bids and negotiate, we've met with the two low bidders on the project and explored how they came up with their pricing for their proposal. And I want to remind you, on this bid, the two low bids were within $12,000 of each other, so very, very close. We went through their pricing, and the materials and equipment estimates were, for the most part, in alignment with a few deviations. But the major difference was in labor. And as we dug into that, there may have been some market conditions at play, but the main reason is we think we underestimated the complexity of the project and how it relates to just the labor hours involved. So getting that story from both bidders, we believe that it's the true price of the work. And we worked with both of them to identify potential value engineering ideas that we could realize quickly without a major redesign effort. And so we came up with about 15 ideas. And between that and just a little bit better pricing with more time, we were able to reduce the proposal by about $150,000, and Strider Construction had the more aggressive credit and resulted in the lower price, and so we want to, we recommend award to Strider Construction. So that resolution that we presented a month ago gives the general manager authority to award that contract, and the only thing left to do is increase the budget by the difference. So that would increase the budget by $760,000. That reserves some construction contingency because we still have the whole project to get through. And it'd be a total project budget of $4.86 million. We have a funding agreement with Ecology that is currently in the amount of $3.5 million. That's made up of $2.175 million in grant funding and the balance in a low-interest loan. And we're currently working with Ecology to explore opportunities to possibly apply for additional funding. Any questions?
Only for the last 8 years. Yeah, no, this is, the closer we get to this, the happier I am. So thank you very much for the work.
We're eager to get started.
Yep. Just joking on the 8 years. It's going to be getting close.
Yeah, it is.
Ron, you might take a second just describe your conversations with Ecology. We were going to cover that in the manager's item.
Sure. So David mentioned that we are exploring some options with Ecology about additional funding, and specifically that's applying again for the similar grant loan package that we applied for back in 2015. So it's the same program. And I spoke with an Ecology staff person last week, and he still felt that we would have a pretty competitive application because the environmental mandate and the project schedule, we still have a compliance deadline that causes us to rank pretty high. Now, we've already received some grant funding for the project, so that'll reduce our eligibility some, and just some other changes with the project will drive the grant eligibility down some. But nonetheless, so you might recall we received about 60% grant funding thus far. But he still feels it will be eligible, and it's certainly worthwhile to apply. Much of the information that was in our original application 3 years ago will be able to carry over to this new application. So it won't represent as much time in submitting an application as it did before. And honestly, I don't see a downside to applying again. Those applications are due October 15th, and we'll go ahead and make progress, make sure we meet that deadline.
And please understand my pop-off comment. It's not finger-pointing or criticism of staff. It's just been a moving target, and you guys have done a great job of working with it and trying to corral it and get the best we can for our customers forward. So I just didn't want it to be taken wrong. So thanks. Other thoughts? All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Great. Thanks.
So, commissioners, on that one, we've given you the proposed motion that would increase the capital budget, and we still have Resolution 14.
Please. Yeah. So I think we better take those separate today.
I think that's probably it.
So let's entertain a motion for item 14, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve Resolution 14 as stated.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept Resolution 14 as stated. Further discussion? Hearing none, those who are in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Did I hear three votes?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Motion is carried. Item 15.
Move to approve item 15. It's a motion to increase the capital project budget for the Peshawson Water Treatment Facility improvements from $4,100,000 to $4,860,000.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded to accept Resolution 15 as presented. Further discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. On to, thank you. On to manager items.
Yeah, we have some substantive things we want to deal with. One of them, I'm going to ask Chad Bowman to come up. This is in response to some questions you asked about our fire risk assessment at the previous board meeting, and we'd committed to get back to you on. So Chad and Steve Wickle will be making a presentation for you.
So I'm Chad Bowman, the Director of Transmission Compliance.
Steve Wickle, Transmission Engineering Manager.
Thank you, Kirk. So this map really outlines the scope of the project, starting back at the Chelan Switchyard, which is down here, the Chelan Substation, which is here, out to Union Valley Substation, which is here, which gives you some geographic perspective of what we're talking about in the presentation. And since you've seen most of the presentation before, I think I'm going to flip through these fairly quickly. Unless you have questions, please stop me. So really the objective, and we're not looking for a decision today, but taking the next step in our wildfire risk assessment into actionable projects that would improve reliability, which is part of the strategic plan, as you know. This is one of the questions you had last time, really about the results of that assessment and what was on that list and what's highest on that list. Actually, the Lake Wenatchee Plain area is highest on that list, and that's a picture over on the right-hand side of a place we affectionately refer to as Dead Horse Canyon. It's out by Winton, really in the middle of nowhere. So that area has high costs, high potential for fire, a lot of federal land. So we're really still working through what we might do there, which is opposed to Chelan, Wapato, Chelan, Manson, which is number two and number four on the list, where we do have a plan of how we might improve reliability in those areas. And then I think it's also interesting to note that number three item on the list, which is just a pretty small stretch of line, we're going to making plans to improve the fire hardiness of those poles as part of another larger project. So here's the Chelan area. This is a slide you've seen before, the Area 1 and Area 2, and really kind of what that project area looks like. our operational experience with the 2015 fire, which the benefits we see in steel transmission line construction and fire hardening. Really a picture of what those steel structures look like compared to wood. Again, that Chelan area in a more schematic presentation with the 8,500 customers that are out there. We did reorder the different approaches here, going from what we perceive as the least benefit to the most benefit. So hopefully that makes a bit more sense. So the first one is to replace some of the structures, the harder to replace structures, rebuild the line from the source of power to Chelan substation, or go all the way to Union Valley. Of course, there's a do-nothing alternative. We did add to this slide that underground transmission we don't believe is a viable option. We added this slide since our last presentation. These were really some things that we were very successful in using during the Eastmont, what was that called, the Eastmont extension, when we relocated a transmission line in East Wenatchee a few years ago. But really, as we get into this, and it's really hard to, as we think about the different options, you either do all of the engineering up front so you can answer customers' questions, or you get customer feedback. And as you work through the project, you can start to provide that information to the customers and adjust your design based on feedback from the customers. So really, we would be committed to sharing that detailed design information with the customers. We went along collaborating to the extent that we can about tweaking things this way or that way to improve individual customers' experience, regular updates, and really those kind of ongoing discussions with the customers as we would progress through this project. And really, with that goal to achieve the greatest reliability for the Chelan area that the community supports. This almost last slide, the added a column here where we have directly benefited and indirectly benefited customers. I think the easiest way to describe that really is that the directly benefited customers would be served by a substation that has a steel transmission line connected to it. So if you're a customer of that substation, the transmission line is very likely to survive a fire. The indirectly benefited customers are customers that are downstream of the improvements. So you're going to get some benefit from that, but your substation isn't going to be directly connected to a steel line. So really next steps, development of this customer outreach plan that we've talked about, and really thinking about and continuing to think about wildfire assessments and impacts, and how do we translate that into an actual project.
Chad, would you take a moment, and I think this is a more detailed map than we've shown the board before, and just kind of describe where the proposed changes are and where houses are, people who might.
Sure, so I'll flip to this last slide, which I'm sure is hard to see as well. But so this is our first look, very preliminary in nature, of those parcels that are shaded in yellow are parcels we believe have a view, front, back, side, some way, of the transmission line. There's, I think, 210 of those. And then in the legend, it's broken down by half mile, quarter mile, eighth of a mile. So really, to answer Steve's question, we'd start down here at the switchyard in all cases, because the switchyard is really the source of power for everybody that lives up here. So if you're rebuilding something and hardening something from the source, you'll get a more benefit from that. And there's two lines that are in parallel that you can't really even see that run from the switchyard, really kind of up the hill past the Chelan Fruit. A couple residences right here at the kind of the top of the hill.
And then it goes and kind of connects to Schlanz substation, which is just right south of Walmart. And then the line runs back behind Walmart and over to Union Valley, which is where the hospital is at. So there's these, you know, this part of town that can has some view of the line. How impactful those customers think that is. You need to reach out and ask them. The warehouse, the industrial section, like I say, there's a couple of nice houses in this area and out in here. So hope that helps.
So, Chad, in those areas, the height of the line going to change, or is it going to be pretty much static where it is?
We would think that in general the height of the line will change, but as we do the detailed design, we know we will run into structures 10%, 20% that are 5 to 10 feet taller or will need to be taller for one reason or another, because we have better survey data, we have better modeling programs. The ground itself under the line has changed for some reason in the past 20 years.
So the taller are required taller?
They would be by the code, safety code, right?
Okay. So we really don't have much of a choice
right
on those, but we can work toward accommodation should we need to.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
For my benefit, Chad, as you look at the wood lines that are there, and I see in the second picture above is that a wood set and a metal set? They're being constructed, and they're very close in proximity.
Right. So the one in the foreground is the steel line, and the one in the background is the wood pole. And so a lot of times, when you're doing the design and construction, and it's a lot, instead of putting the pole exactly back where it was before, if you do what they are shown here where it's 5 feet apart or something, and you can transfer the wire in the air from the old structure to the new structure, it's much more efficient during construction.
And a better base.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other comments? Commissioner Congdon?
No, no, it looks good.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your work on that, Chad.
So let me just describe for a second where I think we are. So you had asked us a couple of questions. First of all, how does this fit within the risk assessment? Hopefully we've answered that, but this mm-hmm. is a high priority in the risk assessment. I think the other question was, can we, as we go out with this, can we explain to customers exactly what it will look like and what the impact will be on them? And the answer is that's really hard to do because there are some options here, and there's the opportunity to work with people as we move along. The poles will be roughly in the same place. The 5 to 10 feet, you know, may or may not impact people. It's hard to tell until we actually get out there and have a conversation. So the idea is that we would begin to move forward to moving out to have a conversation. But I want to add one other piece. We're seeing a lot of load growth in the South Shore area, and it's causing us concern about the need for some potential additional infrastructure investment. So we want to get our arms around that first before we take this out and make sure that if we're going out at one time and talking about there might be more than one project. We're not sure yet. And put that together. So we need to have a little bit more conversation internally to gather our thoughts with respect to what's the package of things that we might want to describe before we actually go out and begin to engage.
I think that's very wise.
Yep. Thank you, gentlemen,
thank
very
you.
Much. I'm sure we'll see more of you.
I want to invite Greg up. He had a follow-up action item on value of mid-sea coordination.
Thank you.
So Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources, and this is a follow-up to Commissioner Arsenault's question about the value of mid-sea coordination. And so I pulled together a few talking points, and for Commissioner Cognin's benefit, I'm going to read these a little bit so that she has the benefit of hearing what they were about. So a couple of things about hourly coordination. The first thing we wanted to make clear is the fact that Chelan PUD was supportive of continuing it. And there's two approaches you could take. One is where you work together with other mid-sea participants and you rebuild a new system that has all of the bells and whistles that you want. The other approach would be to build a system that's independent and then start to patch in the things that you want. And we ultimately decided to go on the latter approach, which is kind of doing it independently, but then adding the things back in. I have down here that the value created by the coordinated system is it has the tendency to increase your heads. You have your reservoirs maintained in a fuller position, because if we have a little reservoir, a reservoir like Wanapum can hold their head and, you know, vary it by a quarter of an inch, where it would be 2 feet on the reservoir of Rock Island Reservoir, as an example. We've worked to preserve value. Some of the things that we're talking about is information sharing will continue in the future, particularly with Bonneville and the federal projects. We're going to have full use of the operating ranges. So when we go out there and we sell a product, we sell the full operating range of the reservoirs themselves. That will not change. We will still continue to sell that as a product. The only thing that may change is that when you start to get too full or too empty, then you have a tendency to want to make sure that you kind of slow down the rate at which you're going. So there may be a slight change associated with that. In the future, we are going to be installing dispatch signals, and we'll have better control of the dispatching of our units. Right now, some of the dispatching has been interrupted because we're in the middle of repairs. But as we get the repairs done and as these systems are put to use, we will be doing a lot better off and have a lot better capability of making sure we dispatch in the most efficient way in the future as well. We are modernizing our control systems. What we have at Grant right now at Central is what we consider to be outdated. We have hardware and software that's very old. It had software that was Fortran programming, and it's no longer used and not very easy to use. So this modernization is going to be very beneficial. And then the other thing that we're doing is we're designing a system that operates at a five-minute interval. Right now, the time step that we use in hourly coordination is an hour. Five-minute intervals are going to be necessary for trading in the California market in the future. So it's going to be modernizing that system as a whole. We expect that as a whole, coordination increased the value of the products we sold, and we see that value in the 0 to 5% range. As far as what the value would be, it depends on who you talk to. But the one thing that hasn't changed is what we sold to our project participants, the full range of the reservoirs, their ability to send us four-second signals. That will not change at all. But as we start to build these things back in and we can operate our units more efficiently, we'd expect the value over time to go. The pie will be bigger. Another, we sold a small pie, and we're going to make the pie bigger eventually through the actions of this. And then finally, we're working with other operators, and we're going to start to rebuild some of the things that we feel are beneficial to all parties. That includes sharing data, making sure that we work together to control total dissolved gas on the system and things of that nature. So let me pause there and see if you have any questions about hourly coordination and ask you if that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much. I appreciate the in-depth analysis in response to that question about risk. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Any other thoughts, comments, questions? Greg, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Before we move on,
okay.
We've had a modest invasion. You know, of the boardroom, and welcome. We're glad you're here. And if you could share a little bit.
Well, that's our next title.
That's your next title. All yeah. right.
So, John, Kerry, do you want to introduce this?
You did it. Whoa.
Did they have to lock the front door?
Oh, there it is.
There's anyone else downstairs.
Oh, wait a minute. This is suspect already because look who has the cake. I'm worried. It wasn't until now.
Oh, Commissioners, John Soule again, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. You know, it doesn't seem it was that long ago we made a big deal out of shooting for 10,000 bills going out paperless through our e-billing program, and very quietly under Carrie's leadership and her team, they surpassed 15,000.
Wow.
So we couldn't pass that up. So just like to turn this over to Carrie to kind of talk about the efforts and how we got here.
Thanks, John. I have to say, I was listening all morning, so you listened to cryptocurrency, you listened to rates, you listened to CIS. And so I just want you all to know that all of that work funnels through this group, and I'm very lucky. This is an awesome group. They work together very well. We get through good times and bad times together, but besides all that, they were able to bring that e-billing up to 15,000. So,
wow.
They work hard every day. They're the front line. They take every phone call, every walk-in customer. So just really important that you see that our goal from the business case back 7 years ago, our goal was only to have 14,000 at this time, and they're up over 15,000 now, and they're still climbing. After I brought it up, all of their numbers have jumped. So. And each of them, we keep track of each of them every month, and all of them, I want to recognize Val. Val has over 500 signups in the last 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And Jamie's right behind her. Jamie hasn't been here for that long, but she's right behind her with over 330, I think. This month she jumped up and passed it. So,
wow.
Everyone, their goal is to get 20 to 25 a month, and, all of them are pretty close. So back in 2011 when we started this, we only had 41% of our payments were made electronically, and now that amount has jumped up to 66%. So over the course of that time, we've made a lot of changes with automatic payment. We have over 12,000 customers that are on autopay. And then back in 2011, we also had 14% of our customers were walk-ins, and now it's down to 8. So our numbers are going down for that traditional check payments and walk-ins. So
wow.
The credit goes to this group. It's an awesome group. And
very good. Great job, everybody.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
And we do have cake. That's the best part.
Well, and all I can say as a commissioner, I really like the system. It has just really worked well, for my family, and appreciate it very much. It's easy.
We hope it gets better.
Yeah.
As we go forward.
Yeah, but thank you all.
Yeah. Great job.
All right. Well, we have a couple people that are filling in, holding down the fort, and the day after the holiday, I think I need to.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that kind of news, come anytime.
That's right. Come visit us anytime.
Yeah, they. Carrie said it well.
Yeah.
This is the team that really makes it all happen and do it day in and day out. And interesting to see those numbers. In the business case, I thought we had a pretty aggressive business case. We made an initial target back in 2011, and then we assumed we'd grow 5% every year on top of that. So we're close to 40% of all bills are paperless. And when you look in the industry and you look at statistics, that's first quartile.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. Thanks, John. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
John, do you want to go ahead and handle your next item while the cake is...
Sure, yeah, and it touches onto this. I want to talk about the Leavenworth operations. We have, as you know, there's a service center up there. That's where our first responder reports out of there. We stage materials. We have crews that work out of there on occasion. Our forestry group is stationed out of there. We also have a cash counter, a people can walk in and make payments. Over the years, we've been watching it very closely, and the trend line is the walk-ins continue to decline, but we staff it full-time. We're looking at an opportunity right now with all the work that's coming at us. You've seen it from the CIS system through applications with cryptocurrency. Our service work is increasing. That's where we see a higher need for utilization of a purpose. Thank you. So over the next month or so, we're going to be working towards reducing the hours. We'll still have a walk-in approach, but it'll be limited. We're looking at Monday and Wednesday, 1 to 5 in the afternoon, and we'll monitor that as we move forward. But just wanted to make you well aware that that's the path we're on.
Okay.
John, I appreciate the heads up on that, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of feedback we get from people, but I agree with that move. I think it's a good move.
Thank you.
Okay. That's actually it for manager items for today.
Okay. Commission items? Do we have any?
No. I don't have nothing for me.
Yeah. Okay.
Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Travel.
Oh, my goodness. We need Lisa, don't we? Look at this. Yeah. Lost control. There's cake.
I know.
That's right.
You serve food, it just goes.
That's right.
You
know?
We need just a moment to do that. So maybe we can first of all mention, just go to the next item and just say we only had one follow-up item from the last meeting, and that was to get you the fire risk analysis. And so we have completed that one, I believe.
Okay. Action items delegation.
So I've got two. And I'm going to add a third one. Commissioners McKenna and Arsenault would like some additional information on cryptocurrency rate options for small miners. We'll try to schedule that for later this week. I actually think that we can do a little bit of work on how we present this to. I was thinking about it as we were sitting here today. So I'd like to have a couple of days to pull that together before we get together with you. And then Commissioner McKenna will be provided additional information on how board decisions impact the CIS project. We'll make that as part of the same discussion there. The other one.
Thank you. I think Commissioner Congdon, did you ask for some tutelage on the crypto?
No,
okay.
I did not.
All right, thank you.
I'm just going to reread it and spend some time, and then if I do need additional help, I'll make a phone call.
Perfect. Thank you very
much. Dennis.
Yes.
And then I think we also will come back to you with respect to the fire risk assessment and that line. Once we've got our arms around whether there's a bigger set of infrastructure investments in that area we want to talk about, so we'll just plan to get back to you on that one before we go out with any conversation publicly.
Okay. Commissioner Travel, you can come back to that.
Did you have that in your packet?
I can.
Lisa, welcome.
Which piece? Did you have the Commissioner Travel? Did you?
Thank you, Lisa.
Yeah.
So enlighten us, please.
Do you want to borrow mine, Commissioner?
We can share.
Yeah.
I can share.
Eric doesn't need it.
Well, for sure he's not a commissioner. But we don't want to be exclusive.
Well, it's a good group. I want to let Eric in. Commissioners, I'm Lisa Sanders. I'm in finance to go over your travel. Not much has changed. Commissioner Smith is no longer planning to attend the September Waputa meetings. Commissioner Congdon is not attending the water workshop, and I just noted that we don't have anyone attending that in case it was important. We have Commissioner Smith attending the Budget Committee, November Association meetings, and the December annual conference. I still haven't seen a room block open for that yet. It's just one page.
Okay. So looking at the November and December meetings, is there any information that Lisa could glean from us that would help her in her preparation to support us?
November, I'll be attending.
You will be? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I as well.
What are the dates on that, Lisa?
The 14th through the 16th.
I hope to, I'll let you know, but I hope to attend.
Okay. We have rooms held, so okay. We'll just make sure to touch base before we hit that no show fee. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Commissioners, any other comments or questions or help that we need from Lisa?
My agenda looks correct.
Thank you. Good.
Yeah.
You okay? All right. Let me know if I can help with anything.
Will do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa.
And along that line, Randy, text, and I will cover the board meeting and the September meetings in Pasco.
Okay.
All right. So, for the voting delegate. I think we're there. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Coming up on the 17th, we have made contact with the City of Wenatchee's City Council, and they will be joining us probably for a portion of our meeting. And Rebecca has been making the arrangements, and I appreciate that greatly. And the topic, there are several. First of all, I'm not sure anybody has memory that we've ever met with the City Council. And it will be here in our chambers. And part of it is just simply relationship building opportunity. Mayor Koontz will be here with members of his council. The topic deals with parking issues. And several things have kind of moved along where some resolution is occurring and some other issues are growing in terms of concern. And we thought it'd be a good time to say thank you and also hear our plea. So if you take a look at the parking that occurs around the Pybus Market, the new hotel that's coming in, et cetera, that's pretty much transitory parking. People come, they go, they stay in the motel, they leave, they go to Pybus, they leave. And so it's a moving traffic pattern. The city has secured a grant that will allow them between essentially the chiropractic clinic across the street and the gym. There's a space in there that is owned by a local entrepreneur who is willing to, it's either lease or sell to the city for a three-story parking garage in that arena. And the city is fully intent, as I understand it, to move forward with the parking garage, as well as an additional 17 spaces underneath the overpass walkway. So it should alleviate some of the concerns that we have. You know, in that area, is there adequate parking to keep people from encroaching in a transitory format for the most part into the parks and not allowing people who are wanting to utilize the parks in a limited time adequate places to park? So that seems to be moving pretty well. I think we've been heard in that area, and the city has been, I think, diligent in responding to that. So I think a thank you for that awareness and that effort is due. At the same time, as you move further north along the waterfront, you get around the, for want of a better geographical description, the Riverside 9 apartments, and there's a lot of new wood on the other side of the street. So there's a building that is occurring there. And again, it's in a housing market. And then further on down is a piece of property owned by the Parlett family that is also has submitted inquiry to extend the opportunity to build housing in that arena. The city has agreed, as I understand it, to pave and provide additional event parking, et cetera, where the paddle club parking lot is, which will help for events. The concern is there adequate parking, and is our understanding of the city's commitment to parking a viable commitment when it's residential? And you know, I've been using the example that let's say I live in one of the new apartments across from Riverside after it opens. I come home from work, it's 5:30, I can't find a place to park, so where do I park? I park in the park. About 6:30, I'm finished with dinner, and I think, I better go find a parking spot. But the Mariners start at 7. So I end up leaving my car there and taking parking spaces that need to be more transitory for people coming in and utilizing. So we have an agreement with the city. We would like to review that. Dan Frazier has agreed as a staff member to be here to flesh in. You know, I think certain areas as commissioners that we're not as aware of as he is because of dealing with that on a more frequent basis. Jeff Smith, prior to leaving, just had an overview of that, of which Dan has access and will be here as a resource for us. But that's kind of the tenor. So meet and greet, welcome, thanks, here's our concern, thanks, we're committed, and we need to help you type of meeting. Is that fair?
And I just said that we are, as staff, putting together a summary of the different communications that have been provided from the PUD to the board over the parking issues over many years. So you'll get that in advance of the next board meeting.
So it's a time to talk about an issue and to build relationships. And over time, we know the value of the relationship. I think it's a really good city council, good leadership, and an opportunity to do some things well. Going once, going twice. And I also have to thank two people, Councilman Jim Bailey, for his willingness to organize and spur the city council in that direction, and for Mayor Coons being gracious and bringing the commission with him, and the opportunity to get to know Frank a little better and his council. So that's kind of the agenda.
Good.
If you have thoughts, comments, questions, that'd be great.
It's a good meeting. I think very worthy of reaching out and having this conversation.
Well, and in talking with Councilman Bailey, we serve the same population. Those are our customers and theirs. Yeah. But we have to be interested in bringing a better level of service, regardless of where people house or where they park. So they're ours as well. So 17th?
Good.
Thank you.
I'd like to bring up a commission item. As you know, I'm serving as the telecom chair at Waputa this year, and we're currently addressing some Governor Inslee's broadband roundtable topics at our next telecom meeting this September, next week in Pasco, where we'll be looking at getting some agreement in principle on topics relative to the principal items that would be of interest to all of the PUDs in the state, trying to bring that together in a cohesive manner, knowing that PDs often have differing levels of telecom within their district.
Some have fiber, some do not, et cetera.
But the key is to do no harm with respect to the PUDs and to the fiber band bill. As it stands, there's a risk that state funding might go to those for-profit telecom institutions and not necessarily benefit the intent, which is rural broadband in the state. Where those dollars might be employed in places where there's high density, Seattle, King County, Snohomish County. Real concern. So at our next WAPUTA meeting, you'll certainly, if you're invited to come drop in on the telecom committee and listen to this discussion as we try to agree on a consensus to move forward.
Okay. Thank you. Any other commission items? Commissioner Travel, going once, going twice. Additional public comment? Since there's no additional public, there's probably no comment. Matters of general business come before the commission. Then, okay, executive session. To discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district court's board is likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.111I. And length of time?
It'll be a maximum of 45 minutes.
Okay. So let's take a quick 5-minute break, reconvene at 2. And hopefully be done at 2:45. Okay, thanks.
Great.
This is Chelan County Board of Directors coming back out of executive session. It is 2:37, and during executive session, no decisions were made, no votes were taken. Is there any other items to come before the commission? Hearing none, we're adjourned.